the Mountain Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me, Martinez. For 9 months, L.A. County school kids have been learning online. And until further notice, just like the mantra of The Mandalorian, this is the way. But we'll hear if there's evidence to prove that it's the best and the safest way. Plus, the state has a plan to help unhoused Californians go from having a key for a room to a key for a home. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. And before we start the show, just an FYI, today is Giving Tuesday. And you, that's right, you, the KPCC listener, the LAS.com reader, you have a chance to make a huge difference for local trustworthy journalism. That would be us. Now, be one of the 400 listeners to donate to KPCC today, and you'll help unlock a $10,000 challenge for the news that you value and love. So give right now, kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. All right, now on to the show. Now, any day now, it appears the state could be shut down again. That's per Governor Gavin Newsom's warning yesterday. Cases of coronavirus continue to climb. Hospitals are filling up, and we have yet to see what spike the Thanksgiving holiday might bring. Now, all of this suggests to families out there that most schools in California will not reopen anytime soon. And for many, that is really a heartbreaking scenario. Already, we've seen some signs of learning loss, and a few parents this week filed a lawsuit against the state for failing to provide equal educational opportunities during the pandemic. But what does the science really say about whether kids should be in class or not? For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Now, Dr. Blumberg, before we get into school specifically, I want to take a look at the big picture that's been filling in over the last week. The message that I keep getting, to quote the New York Times, is that California is in a bad spot and things will likely get worse before they get better. Dr. What is your take on this and why?
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right. think the issue is that what we have now is the models suggest that deaths are going to double by the end of this month and quadruple by the end of January. So we're on an upward rise, and it's projected that we're going to run out of ICU beds sometime later this month. And so that's a huge concern for California.
Quadruple. I mean, does that sound like a number that can't be reversed? I mean, it almost sounds like we're on the Titanic when it comes to this stuff. Like, we can't avoid the iceberg now.
The problem that we have is that we're starting with a relatively high rate of transmission right when we're entering the winter season, when we know that the temperature and the humidity is dropping, and that facilitates viral transmission. Plus, people are indoors more, where the virus is less diluted and people can't social distance as well. Plus, on top of that, we just had Thanksgiving, where we know people visited outside of their households, and we've got Christmas coming up. So we're most definitely going to see another wave of infections resulting from Thanksgiving, and we'll see a wave upon that wave after Christmas.
So when that wave does indeed wash over us, Doctor, what are you concerned about the most when it comes to hospitals?
I don't want it to be a tidal wave. I want to make sure that we've got enough hospital capacity and healthcare capacity to take care of everybody who needs it. We need to all do our part with masking and social distancing to make sure that we don't see scenes like we saw in New York in the spring, that we saw in China earlier in the epidemic, and that we saw in Iran and Italy and other parts of the world.
I realize it's kind of silly to ask you to rank which is your highest concern, but I understand ICU beds filling up. What about staff who get sick, or staff that are just so exhausted they can't work? How much of a concern is that?
Yeah, that's a huge concern, because we know that for healthcare personnel, that the majority of them, when they become infected, they're infected in the community, that the hospitals are safe places to be because we do have adequate PPE, and we've got adequate systems in place and detecting and isolating infected patients. But the problem is, once we have such a high rate of transmission in the community, then the healthcare personnel, the nurses, doctors, respiratory therapists, everybody that's needed to make the hospital work, they become infected, and that further compromises the capacity of the healthcare system.
You know, back in March, Doctor, we didn't know what we didn't know. It's been a few months, and hopefully we know a lot more today than we did back then. When it comes to treating COVID patients, does the fact that we have learned some things give you a bit of optimism maybe about how we might make it through this stage?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know, for example, that social distancing and masking works. Early on, we were not giving the advice to mask. In fact, we were saying, don't bother masking. Now we know that wearing a mask provides 70% protection for the wearer of the mask in terms of getting infected. So not only does it prevent transmission, but it protects the person who's wearing it. So now we know that we have tools available to decrease transmission. We have advances in therapy, not only the antiviral remdesivir, but specific things such as supportive care, having patients with prone positioning when they're on ventilators, steroid therapy, and other therapies that can improve clinical outcomes.
We're talking to Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. All right, the current stay-at-home orders right now, it seems to be a very mixed bag here in LA County and across the state in terms of what's allowed and what is not allowed. So, Doctor, what do we know about where this surge is coming from and how people are most commonly contracting the virus?
A lot of the transmission information that we get comes from contact tracing, and we know we probably don't have enough contact tracing in place because there's so many cases that are occurring now. But many of the cases seem to be related to people visiting other households. And so we know that this is occurring. People go over to somebody else's house for dinner. And then when they're doing this, of course, they're not wearing a mask during dinner because they're eating, and that's going to facilitate transmission. Much of the other transmission is occurring throughout the community in a variety of other ways. Some of these are large gatherings that have been well publicized, and some of these are just transmission as people go about their day-to-day business in the grocery store or other essential business.
Doctor, on contact tracing, I realize I'm going to open the personal liberties Pandora's box here. How much easier would it be if there was a digital component to contact tracing? In other words, in people's cell phones, being able to contact trace them that way.
So many organizations do have this available, but there's still these concerns about the individual liberties and having Big Brother know all your activities and where you are. So even in the organizations that have these, which include businesses, hospitals, schools, et cetera, some people are reluctant to sign up. I think that's a real long-term issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Big Brother would be so bored with mine, Doctor. It'd be here, going home, going to the store, getting something to eat. That'd be about it. All right, now getting to children. Here in LA County, playgrounds have been shut down again, but day camps and other services are still operating, at least for now they are. Any data to back up these choices?
Yeah, so I think that's why contact tracing is so important, because it does provide the data that lets us know which activities are really risky, where transmission is occurring. We know we have experience from schools and other venues that these probably play little role in transmission within the community. A playground, you know, it's a gathering spot. So theoretically, if you have a large number of children who are gathering and not social distancing, that could pose a risk. On the other hand, a playground is outside, and that helps mitigate the risk. Yeah. Because being outside basically dilutes the virus. So I think there's some activities that are really obvious, such as eating in a restaurant or going to a bar, where you know people are going to be indoors and they're not going to be masking, and so that is going to facilitate transmission. Whereas anything that occurs outdoors, if you can make sure that people aren't crowded, that they're able to social distance, you know, at a beach or hiking or other activities, those are going to be a lot safer.
And the key there to what you said, Doctor, is being outside, right? Because I can already see or hear people that go to the gym that are dying for the gym to be open saying, well, you know, what's the difference? You know, it's a playground, it's a jungle gym, kids are doing exercise. What's the difference between a gym? But a gym, most of them at least, are enclosed.
Some of them are, although a lot of the ones that I've seen lately have been moving some of their activities outdoors if they have the opportunity. For example, to if there's an adjacent multi-level garage, they can move to one level of that. Being outdoors is really important for several reasons. One is that there's more space outdoors, so people are generally able to social distance better than indoors. You don't make those compromises where you're just walking by somebody in the hallway. The other is that there's basically an infinite volume of air outdoors compared to indoors. And so the virus is really diluted outdoors compared to indoors, and that'll decrease transmission.
All right, now to schools. Over the weekend, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced plans to reopen public elementary schools starting next Monday, but middle and high schools will stay closed. Doctor, any evidence to suggest that this approach is the correct way to go?
Well, we know that there's no consistent relationship between school closure and reported cases of infection in the population. We've seen this with different countries. We've seen this in different communities. So I think when we start thinking about children going to school, that these sort of activities need to be looked at, and we need to have an open mind about opening up schools, even with high transmission rates in the community, as long as certain conditions are met.
Well, that's one of the things, I guess, that I worry about. My grandkids are at my house because their internet, where they would be living, is not good. So they come from their home to my home to go to school. And I guess if it's a situation, doctor, where the kids go to school and then go right back home, that is a lot safer than going to grandma's house or going to anywhere outside of that little tiny bubble, right?
Yeah, that is. But even so, that's going to pose a risk to everybody in the household. Yeah. So we need to acknowledge that if they're going to school, if they're in a room with 10 other kids and a teacher or two, that those are increased exposures. The child could get infected and they could bring that home and infect the adults at home. And yet the modeling and the experience that we have shows that it really doesn't drive the infection rates within the community like children do when they drive seasonal influenza epidemics. School closures really probably reduce infections by about 2 to 4%. So that school activities probably account for a very small percentage of transmission within the community.
Does that make you at all, Doctor, scratch your head about why we prioritize bars over schools?
Well, I think we need to get the data, and that's why the contact tracing is so important. And even when we're considering opening up schools, the only way to do this is if you have a comprehensive and effective test and contact tracing strategy. So you need to have those tools available. So if you do get a case within a school, that you can isolate those children who came in contact with that case, that you can do comprehensive testing, and that you can limit spread. So we know there's ways to do this, but you have to have the political will to do that. You have to have the resources to do that, and you have to have the personnel to be able to do that.
Now, LA Unified School District is still closed. The prospect for reopening this year seems slim. New York's approach, and I know other schools in other parts of the world have resumed if they ever close. So I'm wondering, what does the research say about why so many U.S. schools should stay closed?
I think the research doesn't show that the schools should stay closed. I think this was a knee-jerk reaction to the pandemic, where it just seemed like we should close schools along with limiting other activities so that we could enhance social distancing. But I think now it's always a good time to reevaluate what evidence is out there and follow the science on this. We know how important schools are for children, and they're important for adults, too. We know we have many working adults. Some models suggest that if we have too dramatic of school closing, that many parents who are healthcare providers will have to stay home and take care of their children rather than have them be at school. And this can actually have adverse effects on mortality, because mortality rates can increase in hospitals if there's not enough healthcare providers available.
Doctor, you're a pediatrician. What's your main concern for young people right now with this situation as it stands with schools?
Well, we know how important schools are for children's learning. That's the primary purpose of schools. But schools are so fundamental to child development, to adolescent development, to their social development and their well-being. Schools provide a place for social and emotional skill development, for safety, for reliable nutrition, for physical therapy, speech therapy, mental health services. So there's so many other things that we rely on school for. So important for children to be in school.
What's your best advice, doctor, on how not to let the stress of this for parents trickled down to kids. You know, kids pick up on what parents are going through, whether they, you know, say it to them or not. So what would be the best advice on that?
I think parents need to provide plenty of self-care for themselves first so that they can take care of themselves and they can be in a good place to be able to take care of and support their children. And they can do a lot of role modeling for their children in this way, too, to take the time, the space that they need to clear their minds and remain healthy.
That's Dr. Dean Blumberg, pediatric infectious disease specialist at UC Davis. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
All right, well, the 2020 census is over. The saga continues. Supreme Court has to make a call that would give President Trump one last way to take another swing in his four-year-long boxing match against California. And if he wins this round, the state could wind up losing long after Trump leaves the ring. Find out what it is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Just a reminder, today is Giving Tuesday, a national day of giving to support nonprofits in your community like us, KPCC and LAist. Listeners and readers just like you make up more than half of the funding here at KPCC and LAist. And funding, that means it all goes to breaking news about wildfires, continuous updates with health experts, as you just heard me do just a minute ago about the pandemic, as well as important election coverage. So please be one of the 400 listeners to join, renew, or make an additional gift right now, and you'll help unlock a $10,000 challenge. Your donation helps us make sure that we have all the resources we could possibly need to keep you informed, especially in the upcoming year. That's right, 2021. Got to be better than 2020. Make a difference this Giving Tuesday by giving right now at kpcc.org. All right, now let's check in on the 2020 census. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments to decide whether President Trump can exclude immigrants without legal status from the census count, population data that will be used to determine how many seats in Congress each state gets. Now, if the Trump administration's plan sticks, California stands to lose representation. Caroline Champlin covers all things census for KPCC. In fact, she makes sense of the census for all of us. Caroline, let's talk more about this plan President Trump is pushing. Why does he want to exclude these specific people?
So the Trump administration designed this policy to take representation away from states that have large communities of immigrants who don't have legal status, and especially states that protect people without legal status. This policy would essentially extract as many undocumented immigrants as the government can find from the census data, like people in ICE detention centers, but also people who've lived in the country for decades and have jobs and homes here. And it still isn't clear just how this calculation would be made, since we mostly just have estimates about these populations. But subtracting any of these people would make certain states look smaller than they actually are. And when it comes to political power in the House of Representatives, population is everything. So if you're missing people, then your state as a whole is at risk of losing seats. This is a very big threat to California. We have an estimated 2 million undocumented immigrants living here, especially concentrated in Los Angeles, and researchers predict that excluding them would cost the state 2 or 3 seats in Congress. And Trump knows that. He even alluded to the potential impact on one state with around 2 million undocumented immigrants in his policy memo. And most people think he was talking about California. California.
Yeah, stands to reason, right? I mean, it's not much of a reach, I guess. Now, this plan has been controversial since it was released, and it went through several courts, got struck down multiple times, and now the Supreme Court is weighing in. So what did the justices make of the policy yesterday?
Well, they acknowledge that there's a lot of precedent working against the memo. Never before have undocumented people been taken out of the census. The plaintiffs, which is a mix of states and cities and counties, pointed to the Constitution, which says the numbers must include the whole number of persons in each state. And they say that that was a deliberate choice of the nation's founders to not make it about voter status or about citizenship. Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's latest Supreme Court appointee, seemed to agree with that argument. She told the government's lawyer that historical evidence really cuts against their case. That lawyer argued in return that the government could have excluded immigrants without legal status at any point in history, but just chose not to. He said this policy is relevant now because we just have more immigration restrictions than in the country's early history. The justices didn't seem to totally buy that take, but the defendants had a backup plan.
Ooh, a plan B, Caroline? What was the plan B?
So the government is trying to get this case delayed until after Trump's policy is implemented and people have been subtracted from the census count. At that point, we know how successfully the Census Bureau managed to remove undocumented immigrants. And the lawyer for the government admitted that it's not very likely they'll identify all undocumented people as the president ordered. It's more feasible for them to just exclude people from ICE detention centers. And when that's clear, the president could release a new memo just focusing on those groups. Then the defendants argue, hypothetically, specific states could challenge specific parts of the apportionment. And the justices were mixed on this suggestion. Chief Justice Roberts had some concerns about waiting.
Well, isn't that going to be like having to unscramble the eggs? I mean, any change in any one state, of course, is going to have ripple effects all across the country. And it does seem like it'd be more manageable at an earlier stage.
But Amy Coney Barrett seemed someone interested in waiting to see the injury to individual states. I talked with Loyola Law Professor Justin Levitt about this, and he said the injury to California is already fairly clear. Our power would likely take a big hit, at least on paper. If that happens, he'd expect the state to jump into the lawsuit to fight the policy. But ultimately, he doesn't think the government's case will hold up. But either way, we're expecting to hear some ruling from the Supreme Court in the next several weeks.
All right, so the Supreme Court could rule against the policy now, or they could essentially just put the case off until January. But Caroline, I don't know, I read the headlines. Aren't we getting close to a new president taking over at that point? I mean, what then?
Yes, there is a really big possibility that President-elect Biden will be the one overseeing the apportionment process. And that's because the Census Bureau says they've run into some problems while processing the data. And NPR has reported that it might not be ready until late January. In that case, Biden has full authority to throw out Trump's memo. And he has condemned the plan in the past. In a tweet this summer, Biden wrote that in America, everyone counts. But there's another issue that Biden's going to have to deal with, and that's how good is the data anyway after the Trump administration rushed the census? And if the count is seriously flawed, can Biden fix it?
We'll check in back with you again. I'm sure we will. That's KPCC's Caroline Champlin. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. One consequence of the coronavirus pandemic here in Los Angeles has been more people living outside in homeless encampments. A big one sprang up in a residential part of Venice concerning nearby homeowners worried about filth, noise, violence, and fires. In this extended feature, Aaron Schrank follows neighbors as they try to get the city to clear the encampment.
I meet homeowner Jenny Cooney in a small garden in the front yard of the yellow house she's lived in for 21 years.
I think you have to be a particular kind of person to live in Venice. There's something about it, but that's, I think, what attracted the people who live in Venice to it. There's a little edge to it, and that edge was fine until recently.
Santa Monica Airport is nearby. So is Penmar Golf Course. But it's hard to see the fairways behind a row of about 70 tents and other shelters made of tarps and wooden pallets. Many people here are like Ian Richards. He was living in Long Beach when COVID hit. Suddenly, the things that allowed him to survive, like panhandling and help from homeless services, disappeared. He thought,
well, I'm either going to watch a bunch of people I know start scrambling for resources, backstabbing each other, or just go figure out a new way in a new place anyway.
So he decided to move to Venice.
It was strange. I ended up out here, and I like it out here.
While the 100 or so unhoused residents got on with their lives, their housed neighbors weren't happy about what they saw.
All of a sudden, We all felt like we were living in a war zone. Active drug dealers, prostitution, and bike chop shops everywhere.
Normally, the city would be doing encampment sweeps that would force the people living here to temporarily take down their tents and move. But due to COVID health concerns, those were stopped. So the tents stayed, and the encampment grew. Cooney says they tried calling the police.
But the police would say, sorry, we'd like to help you, but we're being told we're not allowed to do this, this, and this.
The neighbors shared their frustration about the encampment in Slack groups and emails, collecting video evidence of things that were affecting their quality of life. Kai Lun was at the center of this neighborhood watch effort.
5 emails, sometimes a day, from 5 separate incidents with video, audio.
Including disturbing sounds from the encampment at night, like this. Lun says they sought to convince local authorities that the situation at the encampment was dangerous for the people living there, as well as the rest of the neighborhood.
It's about documenting what's going on in your area and bringing that all together.
They sent it all along to local officials, city, county, fire department, but nothing on the street changed. So they tried other things. They petitioned the city to move the jurisdiction of the jogging path to the Rec and Parks Department and ban camping on it. That didn't work. They tried to piggyback on a federal lawsuit forcing the city to clear encampments near freeways. That didn't work either. They even hired a private security guard to patrol and then an outreach worker for a couple of months to assess people's housing needs.
But there was a certain point where we just couldn't afford to pay for it. And we were feeling like, this is crazy. We're paying for all the things the city's supposed to pay for.
Nothing they did produced any results. Meanwhile, tensions ramped up. The unhoused residents didn't appreciate being constantly filmed and weren't shy about letting the homeowners know. Kai Lun got the message.
I don't know who's living in this trailer. I don't know who's living in this structured house right here. I know that on the street right here, right outside my home, the woman across from me wrote that this is war. Your peace. This is war.
The woman who wrote that is named Ashley. I meet her outside a shack made of tarps, blankets, and old furniture. She moved from Arizona 3 years ago with her now ex-husband. She's been here for 5 months. She complains of being harassed by city workers. She says sanitation's been coming through twice a week, hassling her to make sure there's 3 feet of space on the path for pedestrians.
They'll go and touch your stuff, and they'll take it. And depending on who's working on the sanitation crew, some of them will destroy it and take it.
Ashley tells me she feels dehumanized. She's recorded by neighbors, harassed by city workers, and insulted by passing drivers. But with all that, this is still where she wants to be.
What about the fact that maybe some of us like being out here because we're free? We don't pay bills. We don't have any curfews. We don't have to follow anybody's rules. Out here, we're free.
That's where things stood on Rose Avenue. Tensions rising, no resolution in sight. Until just after 6 a.m. one morning in September, when Kai Lun looked out her window and saw the tall pine trees across the street engulfed in flames. The fire had started at a camp stove being used by someone in the encampment below, and it spread to the overgrown branches above. Luckily, nobody was hurt, but with small fires frequently breaking out, Lun says she was worried for both sides of the street.
While these fires put us in danger, it's not about us. We got freaking sprinklers, water hose, and such, you know? The thing that we've constantly expressed over and over again is we don't want deaths.
At this point, the neighbors were already working with L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin, who represents Venice and was also concerned about what had become the largest encampment in his district. He wanted to help using a new approach known as encampment to home. Instead of providing services to people on an ad hoc basis, shelter would instead be offered to everyone in the group at the same time.
People in an encampment are a community, and addressing a community collectively is often an appropriate and helpful strategy.
Concerned about the fire risk coming from the overgrown trees, the homeowners asked the city to trim them back all the way along the golf course. To do that, the city said it needed access to the trees, which meant in turn clearing out the homeless encampment. After so many months of pushing authorities to do something, anything about the encampment, the homeowners were finally getting what they wanted, although it came in an unexpected way. With 100 people facing displacement, Bonin says that's when LA County and local housing agencies finally agreed to provide outreach, services, and hotel rooms to encampment dwellers through the Project Roomkey program.
It should not take a trigger like that to get this sense of urgency. I mean, this should be the sense of urgency we have everywhere.
So in October, a full year after tents first appeared on the street, outreach workers begin walking through with an offer, motel vouchers to anyone willing to pack their things and leave. For some, it makes sense, like a man named Art, who reluctantly agrees.
You're taking the hotel?
Yeah, I have to. My health
What's up with your health?
Abscesses.
Art's hands and face are covered in sores, which he says appeared a few months back while living without a shower at this encampment. He wants to go inside to get his body clean, but he has to be ready today.
And so, Art, are you going to be in a hotel tonight then?
Yeah, I got one right now.
Are you going to walk over there?
No, I'm going to ride a bike.
He's allowed to bring 2 60-gallon bags, but will have to turn over his tent to sanitation workers. It's those kinds of decisions that are making many here hesitate. Like a Mohawk man I speak to who goes by Kay.
It's too much like an ultimatum. In order to get the hotel, we have to make it to where we can't be here. And if we return here, then we lose our hotel.
Kay's preparing a pan of jumbo shrimp with his neighbor, Kyle Freeman Smith, who says he's tired of being pushed around by authorities.
They're just going to keep on seeing what they can get away with because we allow it, and I'm tired of allowing it. So I'm I'll go to jail if that's what they have to do. I'm staying here.
When I visit the encampment just a few days later, tents have begun to disappear. I go and find Freeman Smith, who's cooking pancakes this time. He says he's still refusing to leave, but his friend Kay seems to have changed his mind.
Yeah, I'm taking it. You are taking it?
Yep. Get me inside, get me resources, get me what I need, and I ain't gotta worry about nothing. They're giving us a chance.
2 weeks later, the jogging path is completely free of tents, surrounded by construction fencing. The tree trimming has begun. I see Kai Lund's husband, Phil, standing on the sidewalk.
I'm just blown away that the city has mobilized, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cherry pickers. Never seen a city operation like this before. It's crazy.
70 people agreed to move into motels on a week-to-week basis. The others simply moved on to set up tents in other parts of Venice. Kai Lund says she's cautiously optimistic, but
I also would like to see that it's not into only hotels. I think that we as a people are owed an understanding of where people are going long term.
The long term plan isn't too clear. The Project Roomkey program is ending, and when the fence here comes down, there's nothing stopping people from coming back. I wonder what's happened to Kyle Freeman Smith, who had told me that he was going to stay here no matter what. Clearly, that hadn't happened. I called Freeman Smith, but he didn't answer, so I texted him. Will you come back to the street after the tree trimming? He texts back just one word. Yeah. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank.
All right, the state has a plan to have unhoused Californians swap room keys for home keys, but the thing is, counties have to want to take part. Find out why that is no luck when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Like a dream to me that somehow came true, and I know tomorrow will still be the same, 'cause we've got a life of love that won't ever change. And
back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. As we've heard, the homeless situation in LA County and really all throughout California has only grown worse during this pandemic. We're talking about more than 150,000 people throughout California who are unable to stay at home or seek proper medical care and are at very high risk of getting sick. But there is a plan underway to house people. It's the evolution of Project Roomkey. That's the program started at the beginning of the pandemic to provide temporary housing in hotels and motels, and it's called Project Homekey. The state is in the process of buying up properties that can be converted to homeless housing, and this week, Los Angeles County will open its first facility under the Homekey program. Here to tell us some more about how things are going, we have Matt Levin. He's the housing and data reporter for Cal Matters and co-hosts the podcast Gimme Shelter. All right, Matt, to start us off, tell us more about Project Homekey and its history. What's its timeline and what's been the program's goal?
Sure. So Project Homekey was launched in July by Governor Gavin Newsom. It's an $800 million program. And the goal is pretty simple. It's to buy as many properties that can be converted to homeless housing in 6 months. And the logic behind it is pretty intuitive as well. You know, right now there's not a ton of people that want to stay in motels or other types of properties that can be easily converted to homeless housing. So the land is relatively cheap. So this is kind of like Black Friday or Cyber Monday for homeless housing for Gavin Newsom.
Tell us how we went, though, from Roomkey to Homekey.
So Roomkey was launched in April, and it was more of an emergency program. And the idea there was we want to get as many people experiencing homelessness out of shelters and out of encampments where the virus can spread very quickly and into a non-congregate living facility like a motel. And at its peak, Roomkey has housed over 22,000 homeless Californians, which is quite a feat. But the program is winding down. And so right now there's about 14,000 homeless Californians that are in motels across the state. And so Project Homekey is kind of the successor to at least partly answer the question of, okay, what are we going to do with all of these people experiencing homelessness that are in these motels now? Where are we going to put them?
How is Project Homekey being funded?
So the first thing to know is it's not really the state's money. It's actually the Trump administration's money, which I think many Californians would be surprised to hear. But that $800 million figure I referenced earlier, that's actually coming from the spring coronavirus relief package that Congress passed. That's how California, which was facing a $54 billion budget deficit, was able to fund this program. But because it's coming from the federal government, there's a significant string attached to it, which is that $800 million all has to be spent, well, now within 30 days by the end of the year. So that's kind of the reason for the breakneck speed that you're seeing these properties being targeted and acquired.
And I know, Matt, part of the fear was that you'd have to give the money back, as you said, to the federal government, to the Trump administration. But now that there will be a Biden administration, is that sense of urgency still there if the money does indeed have to go back?
The sense of urgency is definitely still there. I think the Newsom administration is hopeful that perhaps in another round of stimulus funding, they can get more money to fund the program. But that expiration date is still in existence. And certainly local governments like LA County and the state, they are operating as if they have 30 days left to buy as many properties as they can.
All right. So you mentioned that deadline is coming up pretty quick. Will the state be able to meet its goal by the deadline?
So it depends how you define goals. So the state has targeted about 97 properties to be acquired. So far, only 25 have actually closed escrow, and a few have fallen apart. So 7 projects that the state has awarded local governments money to buy have fallen through. The state says they're pretty confident that the remainder of these 70 plus projects will actually be completed, but it's kind of yet to be determined as we approach a oncoming deadline.
And the state's making it easier for counties to buy these properties, right? I mean, zoning and environmental reviews, they're just skipping right through that.
That's correct. Yeah. And I think that's why homelessness advocates and some of the service providers that are involved in buying these properties and running these properties are very enthusiastic about the program, because, you know, the two things that homeless advocates have wanted for a long time now is a big pot of money and then a way around some of the cumbersome regulations that makes it take a very long time to build homeless housing from scratch. So Homekey provides an avenue around that. There's limited legal avenues for local governments to object to these motel conversions, although some have.
Now, the people that are in Project Roomkey, will they naturally just transition into Project Homekey? How does that going to work? And are the chances good that they'll be able to move along with the new part of the project?
So the short answer is no. Of these 97 projects, many are targeting demographics within the homeless population that aren't the same demographics of those individuals who are in these Project Roomkey hotels, who are mainly seniors and those with pre-existing medical conditions. So there's not really a specific avenue now for existing residents of Roomkey to be transferred into Homekey. That being said, the Newsom administration has freed up more money to either try to extend some of the leases of these hotels or find alternative avenues into housing for Roomkey clients, whether that's a voucher for an apartment building, whether that's permanent housing that was already pre-existing. The problem is that there's just not that much housing to go around, period. And this is a population that's difficult to track.
We're speaking with Matt Levin, housing and data reporter for Cal Matters, also co-host of the podcast Gimme Shelter. Now, tomorrow, a local nonprofit, LA Family Housing, will start moving families into apartments in North Hills. That's in the San Fernando Valley. And this will be the first move in for a Project Home Key in LA. Zeroing in, Matt, on Southern California for a minute, how has Project Home Key been going here so far? Have officials had success buying properties here, or has the program fared better up north?
For the most part, LA County generally has received a significant amount of funding for Home Key, and it has targeted the most properties out of any other kind of jurisdiction that the state has given funds for. So in that sense, LA County is faring well here. Now, again, many of these projects haven't closed escrow yet. So until the signatures are finalized and the I's are dotted and T's crossed, we won't know exactly how much housing has been added to LA County's limited homeless housing stock. But for the most part, the money and the number of units, it bodes well for LA County.
I was reading your piece about Governor Newsom staking a lot of his leadership on solving our homelessness crisis before the pandemic. And then with Project Home Key, Matt, it just seems like he is very, very passionate about this.
Yes, that's right. And I think, not to be cynical about it, but I think that's partly because he is polling so poorly on this issue. So Governor Newsom is still getting good marks in terms of his handling of the pandemic, although a lot of that polling was done before this French Laundry disaster. But in terms of specific issues, by far, he is pulling the worst on homelessness. So a lot of his political capital is at stake here in terms of the success of this program. The problem for him is, even if this program is incredibly successful, it doesn't mean you'll see a visible reduction in tents on the street or the number of people sleeping outdoors. You know, there's over 150,000 people, as you mentioned, who are experiencing homelessness in California. And there's the threat of thousands more becoming homeless after the eviction moratorium expires in January. So, you know, it's tough to tell Californians, hey, things would have been worse if we did not do this.
That's Matt Levin, housing and data reporter for Cal Matters, also co-host of the podcast Gimme Shelter, giving us an update on Project Home Key. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, you've heard how critical brain development happens in the first 5 years of a person's life. Actually, for me, that was my peak brain development. Anyway, if you remember a couple of years ago, Gavin Newsom made early childhood health a prominent part of his campaign. We'll hear how that has developed when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasure.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. You know, we just had Black Friday. We also had Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday. Well, today is Giving Tuesday. That's a national day of giving to support nonprofits in your community, like us, KPCC. Listeners just like you make up more than half of the funding here at KPCC, funding that we use for breaking news about all the stuff that happens in your neighborhood with your neighbors, wildfires, continuous updates with health experts about COVID, as well as important election coverage that still continues. So please be one of the 400 listeners to join, renew, or make an additional gift today, and you'll help unlock a $10,000 challenge all for us. So please, we need your help. Plus, I heard from the cool kids at LAist that they're giving away LAist masks if you donate. How about that? An LAist mask. Your donation also makes sure we have all the resources we need to help keep you informed. So make a difference right now. Go to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. All right, moving on. You might remember that the governor's race 2 years ago had a big focus on growing minds. Now, after all, critical brain development happens in the first 5 years of life, and Governor Gavin Newsom made early childhood issues a key part of his campaign, everything from prenatal care to what California could do to improve preschool access. KPCC's Mariana Dale joins us now for an update on all of those plans. Now, Mariana, the state released what it's called a master plan for early learning and care, right? So tell us how this plan was created and how it all came about.
Yeah, it's a pretty fancy sounding title, but really what this 107-page document does is take a bunch of ideas like providing access to preschool for all four-year-olds in the state and then describe how California is going to go about actually making them a reality. And so this is the result of more than a year of work. Actually, in the 1920 state budget, lawmakers said, okay, you're going to get $5 million to create this plan. The state worked with educational research nonprofit WestEd, who in turn reached out to smart folks at Stanford University and different think tanks and other groups of stakeholders to help develop it. And throughout the year, I've been following the Early Childhood Policy Council. It's a group of parents, childcare workers, and other advocates. They've been meeting virtually to talk about what exactly they want to see in this plan.
So tell us some of the highlights.
Well, they envision California where all four-year-olds, regardless of income, have access to preschool, and then eventually extending that to three-year-olds from low-income families and children with disabilities. They would expand the state paid family leave program so new parents could take more time off to care for newborns and get more of their wages. There would be no more preschool suspensions and expulsions at subsidized programs. Providers would have a different pay scale than the one they have now, which is not that great. Yeah. And there would be money to renovate, expand, and build new childcare facilities.
So, Mariana, let's zoom in on universal preschool. What exactly might all that look like?
So let me tell you what it's like right now. There is a state preschool program, but only kids from families that make 70% or below the state median income can attend. So you don't have to do the math. That would be like a family of four with a household income of $70,000 or lower every year. And so under this plan, that program would be extended to all four-year-olds free of charge. And the first priority would be programs at elementary schools in high-poverty neighborhoods. Then over time, you know, those three-year-olds and then from low-income families, also kids with disabilities. And to make that happen, the state would need to hugely grow the existing early educator workforce, which is largely of women of color. In LA County, the average pay for a childcare worker is $14.65 an hour. And advocates say better wages and working conditions are going to go a long way to help make that happen. And then, of course, we'd have to get the legislature involved to actually make laws that regulate this brand new universal preschool program.
So how's the state going to pay for all this?
That is a big question. Yeah. All of these ideas cost money, and the master plan outlines this huge range between $2 billion and $12 billion. And it's not really clear over what period of time that money would be spent or where it would come from. If you remember, the most recent budget had a huge deficit of like $54 million. So there's not a lot of extra money lying around. And so right now, there's this mix of federal, state, and donations basically that keep the current programs afloat. They do seem hopeful that the incoming federal administration might be able to support this. President-elect Joe Biden has his own early learning and care plan that overlaps a lot with California's, but it really sounds like we need a new revenue stream to support this. I've already heard from one advocacy group, Children Now. They are disappointed with the lack of specifics in this plan in terms of funding.
We all know the pandemic has had a huge impact on families. Everyone's dealing with Zoom preschool. Childcare has gotten harder to find than it already was. How does the master plan take all of that into consideration?
Yeah, right now, the state agency that licenses childcare estimates at least 2,400 providers have closed permanently since the start of the pandemic. Those that are open, paying more for supplies, upgrading their internet so kids can do distance learning, all while serving fewer children because of the COVID-19 safety guidelines, or parents keeping their kids home. And then those parents are worried their kids won't be on track academically in the future. The master plan, from what I can tell, isn't going to change any of those things tomorrow.
All right, that's KPCC's Mariana Dale. Thanks for keeping us updated. You can get in touch with her at LAS.com if you've got questions about that master plan. Mariana, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, don't forget, you can find us wherever you get your podcast, the whole show right there for you to listen to. Please, please find us. We are there waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.